Hi, I'm John Kurland. I'm the regional administrator for the National Marine Fisheries Service based over in Juneau. Thanks everybody for coming out on a Sunday, sunny night, not Sunday night. I wanted to schedule this meeting because I know that a lot of people who live in Sitka and people who would be here for the council meeting have a lot of questions and concerns about the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit, what the agency is doing to respond, what the latest is, and our efforts to try to provide incidental take coverage to allow the fishery to proceed. So I'm here to try to give an update and answer questions as best I can, you know, recognizing that we are in litigation and so maybe a little bit constrained in what I can say. So that's the purpose of the meeting. I'd like to introduce Julie Fair, who's our public affairs officer. She'll just kind of go over some logistics, and then we're going to hear from Molly Watson with our general counsel's office, and then I'll give you a little bit of an update on what's going on with the lawsuit. So, Julie.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon, everybody. As John said, this is how the meeting's going to go. First, Molly will give a brief statement, and then John will give an overview of where we are and any updates that he can provide. Then we'll open the meeting for Q&As. The participants who are joining us virtually are in listen mode only, but the meeting participants who are present in the room here in Sitka will take Q&As from you. So here's a little bit of the meeting logistics. Virtual participants will be in listen mode only. When others are speaking, please listen. Background talk can be distracting. For those in the room, if you want to ask a question, please raise your hand and wait to be called upon. Then I will bring the microphone to you, and you can then step up to the mic, state your name and community, and then ask your question. And again, John will answer those to the best of his ability. Priority will be given to those who have not previously asked a question. And please be respectful. Back to you, John.
Good evening, everyone. As John said, my name is Molly Watson. I'm an attorney with NOAA's Office of General Counsel in Juneau, and I am one of the attorneys who's been working on this case. So as everyone here is acutely aware, this case has been ongoing since 2020. We've litigated the merits and lost before the district court, and we've also have a final decision on remedy. All the parties have now filed appeals to the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, so we are continuing to actively litigate this case. Given the current procedural posture, NOAA GC has advised that NIMS should be cautious about it, what it says here tonight. I know that's probably frustrating to hear, but we just wanna make sure that we're not getting cross with the court or being perceived as getting cross with the court. And we also want to preserve our opportunities for flexibility as we continue to explore all options for responding to the court's decision. So we probably won't be sharing detailed information about litigation strategies or options for responding to the court's decision on the merits and on remedy. But as John said, we're going to try and do our best to answer your questions. Thank you.
Okay, we'll try to speak up. I'm going to sit down if that's all right. Hopefully folks can see okay. Thanks, Molly, for going over that. And, you know, just to be very clear, I'm not going to be making any big announcements. We don't have any big news to share here. This is really just kind of an update on what's been happening with the suit and our efforts to try to get incidental take coverage in place for the fishery. So first off, I know that there's been just a huge amount of concern about the implications of this suit and the potential for the troll fishery not to be able to open. I live in Juneau. I have a sense of how important this fishery is for Southeast Alaska, for a lot of small businesses, a lot of families, a lot of communities. It's a big deal. And that has been weighing on us in the agency as we've been responding to this litigation and doing what we can to try to address the issues that the court has plunked in our lap. So the National Marine Fisheries Service is the defendant in this suit, as Molly indicated. So it was a suit brought by the Wild Fish Conservancy. We were joined by the Alaska Trollers Association and the state of Alaska. They are defendant interveners, so they have joined the suit kind of on behalf of the agency. And we all have pretty much the same interests or compatible interests in trying to defend and respond to the suit. And frankly, I think all of those parties, the National Marine Fisheries Service, the state, the Trollers Association, are all kind of incredulous about why we're dealing with this suit in the first place, why this suit is targeting...
Your host has turned on an audio lock, so you're muted and can't unmute yourself.
Thank you.
You can now unmute yourself by pressing *6. Your host has turned on an audio lock, so you're muted and can't unmute yourself. You can now unmute yourself by pressing *6.
All right. Hopefully that's the last time that'll happen. We're all sort of incredulous that this suit is focusing on Southeast Alaska fisheries when there are a lot bigger threats that southern resident killer whales are facing than what's happening in these fisheries. The Southeast Alaska fisheries are a really small contributor to the challenges that southern resident killer whales face in their recovery. But anyway, it is what it is, and we are dealing with this suit. And I'll kind of give you the bottom line up front, which is that we in the National Marine Fisheries Service are doing everything that we can to respond to the court's orders and prepare the analyses required by the court to be able to put incidental take coverage in place and allow the fishery to open. I'm honestly not sure whether we can get there by July 1st and satisfy the legal requirements, but we are doing all that we can to get to that place.
Hello?
That is our goal.
Hello?
So let me give you a bit of background on what the suit is all about. And a lot of you are probably familiar with this, but I just want to make sure everybody is kind of in the same
place. Hey, Craig, can you hear me? I guess they're having some technical difficulties. It's my impression of what's going on, which is kind of a bummer. So we're just going to sit tight.
Sounds good. I'm seeing other people here, and I'm just curious. All right, sounds good. I'll sit tight.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Yep, bye.
Can folks online hear me?
I can.
All right. It sounds like that's a yes. All right. We'll just ask everybody to please stay on mute so that folks here in the room can hear and we can proceed with the conversation. So background on this suit. The Wild Fish Conservancy filed suit to challenge a 2019 biological opinion, which is an analysis that the National Marine Fisheries Service did under the Endangered Species Act. And that analysis addressed three different actions. One is the delegation of authority from the National Marine Fisheries Service to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to manage the salmon fishery in federal waters in Southeast Alaska. A second is grant funding from the National Marine Fisheries Service to the state to help implement provisions of the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the agreement under that treaty. And then third is operation of a mitigation program that is not just for Alaska, but for the Pacific Northwest to address effects to Endangered Species Act listed Puget Sound Chinook salmon and to southern resident killer whales. So what is a biological opinion? For those who may not be familiar with that, biological opinions are required under the Endangered Species Act to evaluate the effects of federal actions and make sure those federal actions won't jeopardize the continued existence of a threatened or endangered species. So that's why we had to do the analysis. A component of a biological opinion or something that's issued with a biological opinion is what's called an incidental take statement, or ITS. You'll hear that term a lot because that's kind of at the crux of this case. The incidental take statement is what authorizes, in this case, the fishery to take threatened and endangered species incidental to operating the fishery. So that's both direct take of fish that are listed as threatened or endangered and indirect take. So in this case, that's prey that are taken in the fishery, fish that are taken in the fishery that would otherwise have been available to southern resident killer whales, which are an endangered species. So that's what the analysis was that was the basis for the suit. We received an adverse decision from the district court in July of 2022, so about a year ago. The court found fault with our biological opinion and found some things that the court thought we needed to do differently, and also found that we needed to comply with another law called the National Environmental Policy Act and do an environmental analysis related to issuance of the incidental take statements. So we started work on those analyses pretty much immediately last year, recognizing that, you know, it was a lot to do, and that was likely to be what would be included in the remedy order from the court. We had gotten a ways down that path, and then about a month ago, we received the final remedy order from the court, and that was a decision that, in addition to requiring us to do those analyses, which we were expecting, the court also vacated the incidental take statement from 2019. So that means the incidental take statement is not in effect any longer. We asked the court to leave it in effect while we complete the new analyses, but the court declined to do that. So that really ramped up the urgency on the new analyses that we're doing and kind of raised the stakes, because without that incidental take coverage, both the state of Alaska and individual fishermen could face liability under the Endangered Species Act for any takes of threatened or endangered species. The Department of Fish and Game, as I'm sure you're all aware, has announced that it will not open the fishery without incidental take coverage, and retention of Chinook salmon throughout the summer season would not be permissible. And that's an understandable position for the state to take because of that liability of not having the take coverage under the Endangered Species Act. It is frustrating that the Southeast Alaska fisheries are the only ones facing this. The Puget Sound fisheries are not. The salmon fishery off the west coast of the U.S., off California, Oregon, and Washington is not facing this kind of position, but it's just a kind of a peculiarity of the way this suit was framed and the court's orders. So what is the National Marine Fisheries Service doing to respond to this situation? We are developing new analyses under both the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act to address the deficiencies identified by the court, both with respect to the Southeast Alaska troll fisheries and to the mitigation program, the prey release program that I mentioned before. Staff in our Alaska region, my office based in Juneau, and staff in our West Coast region have been working really, really hard on these analyses ever since we got the decision on the merits last July, and have come a long way in developing those new analyses. But there are a lot of legal complexities in this situation, including the relationship between the different components of the court's remand order, the components related to the Southeast Alaska fishery, as well as the components related to the prey increase program. There are a lot of nuances to that, a lot of legal intricacies, and it's because of that that I'm not able to tell you definitively when we'll be able to get incidental take coverage in place. It's not that I'm holding that information back, I just don't know. But that's what we're dealing with. Molly touched on the current status of the case, but I'll just review that again quickly. So the state of Alaska requested a stay on the court order pending appeal. So that means having the court's judgment not be in effect while an appeal plays out. The district court pretty promptly denied that request, and the state made the same request to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and asked for a decision by June 23rd. So we would have that roughly a week before the scheduled opening of the fishery. Both the National Marine Fisheries Service and the Alaska Trawlers Association have asked for essentially the same thing, supported that same request for a stay pending appeal. And just last Friday, the Alaska Congressional delegation filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, asking the court for the same thing, expressing support for a stay, which would allow that 2019 incidental take statement to remain in place. If the stay is granted, then the fishery would continue to have coverage under the Endangered Species Act, and that would take the pressure off while we're completing the remand work that the court has ordered. If it's not granted, then we're still in a bit of a pickle. Meanwhile, the Wild Fish Conservancy has just recently asked for an injunction on the prey increase program pending appeal. That was something that they sought in the merits phase of the litigation and they did not get, but they've asked for it again in this remedy phase. That would actually take prey away from southern resident killer whales, so go figure. But anyway, that's what they have asked for. We have opposed that. And the other parties have as well. Not directly related to this litigation, but also related to Wild Fish Conservancy, they have announced their intent to petition the National Marine Fisheries Service to list Chinook salmon under the Endangered Species Act in Southeast Alaska and South Central and Cook Inlet. We haven't received that petition yet, but they've kind of put us on notice that we will be receiving that petition under the Endangered Species Act. So what are the effects of the Southeast Alaska troll fisheries on prey for southern resident killer whales? Under the 2019 Pacific Salmon Treaty Agreement, the Southeast Alaska fisheries catch of Chinook salmon will be reduced, in most cases by about 7.5% relative to the level of take under the previous 10-year agreement in 2009. So based on that, we would anticipate the fishery would have reduced effects on southern resident killer whales, totally apart from this litigation, just under the salmon treaty. It's also important to keep in mind that not all Chinook salmon taken by the troll fishery in Southeast Alaska would have been available to be fed upon by southern resident killer whales. Some of those fish would migrate elsewhere, not to places where southern resident killer whales feed. Some of them would die of natural mortality or other sources before they could be eaten by a killer whale. So it's not like every Chinook that is taken by this fishery is coming out of the mouth of one of those endangered killer whales. In the 2019 biop, we estimated that all of the Southeast Alaska fisheries would reduce southern resident killer whale prey availability by a tiny percentage. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but by a small percentage. We are updating that as part of this new analysis. On remand, we'll be using a model with updated methodologies to try to estimate the effects of the Southeast Alaska fisheries on prey removal for southern resident killer whales. And I don't want to give anybody the impression we don't care about the southern resident killer whales. We do. That's part of our agency's mandate, is to help recover those killer whales. So we have to account for anything that's going to harm them. But it's just kind of important to put in perspective the threats from this fishery compared to other things. So the bottom line, one more time, the National Marine Fisheries Service is really not happy about where we are with this litigation. We're not happy to be in this position. Lawsuits take a lot of time and effort from a lot of people to respond to, and obviously the implications of this are causing a lot of grief and concern for an awful lot of people in Southeast Alaska. We are working very closely with the Department of Justice to examine all the available options for providing incidental take coverage for the Southeast Alaska troll fisheries. As the regional administrator, I've been focusing an awful lot of time and effort on this issue and working towards making sure our analyses are moving forward to address the deficiencies identified by the court and trying to find a solution to keep the troll fishery open. My agency's director, Janet Coit, is also tracking this really closely and is keenly aware of the situation and fully supportive of NIMPS doing all that we can to keep the fishery open. And likewise, the Alaska Congressional Delegation has been tracking this super closely, has been keenly aware, has been checking in with us regularly, and has been fully supportive, as evidenced by that friend of the court brief that I mentioned that they filed on Friday. Thank you all for your patience and support. I know a lot of you have been lobbying government at all levels. You know, we've had resolutions from municipal governments. People have been going back to D.C. People have been talking to the congressional delegation. I think it's really important for your voices to be heard, and you have been heard. The challenge at this point is whether we can navigate a path in the context of this litigation to allow the fishery to open. And I am hopeful, but I am not certain, and I just want to be very honest about that. So that's really all I intended to cover. I'd be happy to try to answer questions. This is really not meant as a forum for public testimony, although I'm sure people have a lot they want to get off their chests. But really, it was just an opportunity to tell you what I could, be as honest as I can about our situation, and I'll be perhaps a little bit constrained in answers to your questions by the litigation, as Molly indicated at the outset, but I'd be happy to try to answer questions as best I can. So that's where we are, and Sarah, I'll let you lead off. And Julie's going to circulate a mic around, so if I do call on you, please give it a minute until the mic gets to you.
Hi, Matt Donahoe of the Alaska Trollers Association, and I live in Sitka. Can you give us an idea on a timeline on the biop and the ITS? I understand if you can't, but any idea that you can. I've already asked you this, but just so the public hears it, what the likelihood of hearing from the Ninth Circuit by the 23rd of June on the motion for the stay? So the timeline on the ATS and biop and the motion.
Sure. So all I can say on the timeline is that we are actively working on the new analyses to get the incidental take statement in place. And as I indicated, there are a lot of legal complexities to that. So we're trying to navigate that. We want to make sure that if we are able to issue incidental take coverage, that it's something that's robust and responsive to the court's orders. With regard to the schedule for the request for a stay, courts aren't very good at following schedules. I'm sure the court is aware of the request for a determination by June 23rd, but it's not something we have any control over, and courts don't tend to tip their hands on when they're going to rule on something. So we really don't know is the short answer. Yep. Other questions?
Yeah. Hi, Jackie Foss, ATA here in Sitka. We're stuck as trollers until the courts or NIMS acts. That's not like an indictment on you guys doing your job, but what can we do as citizens, as the people whose livelihood depends on this? How can we best advocate to make sure that all timelines are met and you have what you need to get this done?
Yeah, thanks very much for that question. And a number of people have asked me variations on that about, you know, what can we do? And do you have all the resources? You, the agency, have all the resources you need to respond. At this point, we are pretty far along in trying to do analyses responsive to what the court is looking for. We've got a ways to go, but we're pretty far along. I think the kinds of advocacy that that ATA and other groups have been doing has been fantastic. It really has elevated the profile of this issue and helped people understand what's at stake, that this is not a small thing, and it has big impacts on people's lives. So I guess the best thing I can say is keep it up. The same kind of advocacy that you and others have been doing is really important. Particularly if a few weeks go by and we're getting closer to the deadline and nothing has happened, I think continuing to be vocal about it is helpful. Courts often aren't really swayed by that sort of thing, but it can't hurt. You know, it's important to let people know that that this is a big deal and has real impacts on people's lives. Yeah, thanks for the question. Other questions?
Hi, done. I just wanted to start by thanking you, ATA, ADF&G, you know, Karina, who's here from our delegation, staffers, for all they're doing to try and get the fishery open. It's been a huge group effort in the fleet to try and move this forward. I really appreciate the commitment of your staff to moving this forward. My question, and I don't know if it's one you can answer, but if you can talk about what is going to be done different in this next biop, given that we are so legally vulnerable, clearly, with this biop and this ITS, what will be different going forward that will prevent Wild Fish Conservancy from just repeating this and be successful with shutting down our fishery or other fisheries in Alaska? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Linda, for your acknowledgement of the effort. And you're absolutely right. This has been a huge group effort with advocacy from a lot of people and a lot of work by a lot of people. I really can't go into details about what we're doing analytically that is distinct from what we did in the 2019 biop, other than to say we are trying to be as responsive as we can to the deficiencies identified by the court.
My exercise in.
Thank you. Drew Terhar, Triller, Sitka. With the new ITS or the biop, does the court need to approve that before it goes into action in any way?
Yeah, thanks for the question. So the agency has the authority under the Endangered Species Act to issue a new biological opinion and a new incidental take statement. It could be reviewed by the court. The court doesn't need to approve it up front, but it's certainly possible that the plaintiffs will take issue with whatever we put out, and will ask the court to review it. But there is no implicit requirement or explicit requirement for the court to approve it before it takes effect.
John, I was curious if you could talk about the prey, or not. I don't even like calling it the prey increase program, but the program to release additional smolts to feed the orcas and other fisheries. And basically, I'm going to ask you to tell me if I'm correct or not. My understanding of that program is that there are actually more abundant fish for the stocks that the orcas have historically fed on than there were during the 1990s, and it fluctuates from year to year, as we all know as fishermen. In my understanding of the program, it was designed to supply these fish, most of which are not far north migrators, meaning they don't come to Alaska, but rather Puget Sound fish in Columbia River Springs, for when there would be years of extremely low abundance. Is that a correct description of that program?
I am actually not sure. I'm not an expert on all the nuances of that, so I would hesitate to give you an answer off the cuff, but that's something we can get you an answer to.
There was one up front here, Julie.
Thanks. So let's say you had all of your paperwork ready this afternoon. Let's say it was done. Is conducting an appeal or making an appeal in the court still necessary under those circumstances? Would you carry on with an appeal? Would all the defendants carry on with an appeal if the paperwork, you know, if you had satisfied the court by creating the incidental take statement and the biological opinion?
If I understand your question correctly, it kind of gets to legal strategy, so probably something I really can't address.
Hi, Deborah Lyons, and I'm the treaty rep for ATA. In Alaska, our system, when regulations are changed, it happens through our Board of Fisheries process. And if someone is unhappy about a management decision or a different quota or something like that, that's the process they go through. Occasionally, people try to take a Board of Fish decision up to the court level. and sue over fisheries decision. But in Alaska, the courts are very reluctant to overrule state legislatively established method for hearing fisheries issues and ruling on them in a body of people that were, you know, selected because they're experts on fisheries. So when I look at what happened in Washington, NIMS, who are the experts on fisheries, issued an opinion that said the Southeast fishery, yes, takes some threatened salmon and takes some salmon that are prey of an endangered whale, but in the opinion of National Marine Fisheries Service, it was not a significant threat to any of those species. And yet a group was allowed to appeal to a judge and provide hand-selected bits of data that the judge found more compelling than the opinion of the agency, the federal agency that's supposed to render these decisions. Now, how does that happen? I mean, does that mean there should be some change in how ESA is allowed to be reviewed? Or what's your thinking about the process we have here and where you found yourself with a judge over ruling a decision just based on hand-selected data that the court was fed?
Thanks for the question. I think what you're getting at is really related to the citizen suit provision of the Endangered Species Act, that under that piece of legislation, citizens have the opportunity to file suit to challenge actions or inaction under the Endangered Species Act, and that's what the Wild Fish Conservancy did in this case.
But why would the court give more deference to information that's being provided to back up an agenda of the people bringing the lawsuit than they would of the agency that it's supposed to be, you know, expert in the science behind why you made your own decision?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I take it as a rhetorical question. the court acts in the court's judgment and evaluates the information in front of it. Obviously, we don't agree with it, but that was the decision of the court.
Thank you so much for coming, and thank all of you for showing up. My name is Eric Jordan. My grandfather trolled in Alaska, and my grandchildren troll in Alaska. Does the court understand, does National Marine Fisheries Service understand the inequities of hardworking Southeast Alaska trawlers being shut down? Well, port fishermen and others in the state of Washington, which catch far more of these fish, are left unabated. Rich people from Washington are traveling up here and by the hundreds and playing with these fish, harvesting them, while us hardworking Alaska families, and I had a gal with a four-year-old child whose husband is a troller, literally pour her heart out to me. And the inequities of this, trollers, and I've represented trollers, either appointed or elected to represent them continuously since 1976. Trollers fight to conserve these resources. Does people who are trying to save salmon, and I'm getting to the question here again to you, should be allying with us. Ever since I read Return to the River when I was 12 years old, the classic about king salmon, I have been working to conserve them, been members of conservation groups, Save Our Wild Salmon, on and on, like a lot of trawlers. And we've made a difference. There's no ground fish trawling off the coast of Southeast Alaska in good part to this woman and Alpha and ATA. There's no high seas gill netting that's for salmon anymore. CCOPS, this was the first, my friend Pat Wood was chairman of CCOPS. We have done so much to protect habitat, to enhance. Trawlers helped start Ensurah here. I see our general manager right over there. In our ocean ranching program in Southeast Alaska, we produced over $1 billion worth of harvested salmon and created millions of salmon lives since we started those programs in the 70s. Is there any real empathy for we are salmon conservationists? We stand with salmon. The former, I see I'm standing right next to our state senator. I nominated the great Dick Eliason to the Wild Salmon Hall of Fame, where he was a finalist, because of the work we did, and he was a troller. We have the strongest wild salmon protection measures in the world, in legislation. And for us conservationists to be denied an opportunity to continue to fish one at a time for these creatures that we help sustain. Do you understand that? Does the court understand that? Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comments. I can't possibly understand it the way that you do, but I hear you. And I certainly can't speak to whether the court understands it, but we hope that they do, and we have been trying, in all of our filings in this litigation, trying to impress upon the court the nature of this fishery, that it's small family-owned businesses, it's very small communities, it's very sustainable, and not what we view as a significant impact on the southern resident killer whales. Unfortunately, we are where we are with this litigation. Thank you for your comments.
Yeah, I'm Tom Chide, and I have a question. And do they think these people signing a lawsuit against us think that king salmon is the only thing orcas eat? That is total BS. They eat all kinds of fish in the ocean. And how do they prove that it's the lack of, you know, king salmon that is causing this? And there's all kinds of fish that have been depleted. And I know they eat coho. I know they eat herring. You know, I watched killer whales or orcas, you know, feeding on herring together and bunching them up and then going through them and eating them, similar to the, you know, whales that bubble feed, but they just surround them and they kind of bunch them up and then they go through them, and I've watched them do that. So that's not the only fish in the ocean that king orcas eat. They don't eat just king salmon. So how do they prove that that is true? You know, how do they know that that's the reason they're having a problem with their orcas, other than their pollution down there, which is horrendous, you know? So that's what I have to say. I know there's a depletion of herring massively in Southeast and in Washington. You know, if you look, there was a herring study done by the University of Washington, and it tells you it the whole West Coast, and that's one thing to eat also. So, you know, it's not the only fish that a king or a orca eats. They eat coho, they probably eat dogs, they'll eat anything when they need a meal. And so what's around is what they're going to eat. And I don't know how they have proved it that it's a salmon that's causing them to starve to death, whatever they think is happening. And that's what I have to say. I don't think they've proven anything, you know.
Yeah, my understanding is that there is pretty good information that southern resident killer whales feed preferentially on Chinook salmon. You know, yeah, right, I do too. you know, no, that's right, that's right. But, you know, it's true for beluga whales in Cook Inlet. It's true, you know, not surprising perhaps, but you're absolutely right. They do feed on other things. That's right.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my question. I wanted to thank you also, John, for coming. You came into the lion's den. That takes some grit. Everybody's been pretty polite. I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to ask an impertinent question. So, I wanted to establish something, and if you dispute any of it, that's fine. That's perfectly fine. Let me know how I got my facts wrong. My understanding is in December of 18, the state of Alaska wrote a response, an objection letter to the draft biop that was proposed before it was ultimately signed in April of 19. And in it, I'll just read a couple of quick things and then I get a question about it. The decision, there's a lot that's said in here, but I made copies if anybody wants one, and I'm happy to give one to you as well. But the decision to only consult on Sikh fisheries is not adequately justified or explained in the document and appears arbitrary. The net effect of the biop that ignores all the non-Alaska fisheries in the PST area creates a linkage between Sikh fisheries to the recovery of the southern resident killer whales without recognition of the much larger impact that Canadian and southern U.S. salmon fisheries have on that population. And what I want to say about that was, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. I mean, one of my friends, one of the things he often says, and I believe it, fishing isn't the problem. They have a very complex problem down there, and a lot of it is tied to their inability to look in the mirror. You know, they have toxic waste, they've got noise pollution, they've got all sorts of problems down there. In fact, they had 60 southern resident killer whales that were abducted for the amusement of tourists, you know. So if you add that to the, whatever it is, 73 or 75, make a pretty big difference. And so I guess my question is, the NEPA statement, to my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't done. And it seems like that had to be done, and that was one of the linchpins in which we were sued. And I guess the point I would make is, I blame the wild fish conspiracy for a lot of things, but I feel as though NIMS made us vulnerable. And I'm not trying to impute motives. I don't think there's active hostility. I'm not saying it was malign negligence. It could be as simply as they were trying to use mollifying language for the people that care about killer whales, among which I include myself. My question is, going forward, are we going to eliminate that sort of justification where, because my understanding was our money was tied to this whole biop also. So if there was any problem with it, you know, we might not get the money, which is probably one of the reasons why the state of Alaska signed the document or signed off on it and didn't appeal it, you know. So my question is, going forward, is NIMS going to forthrightly and directly and forcefully confront that problem where we're singled out and we're on the hook for the recovery of the southern resident killer whales recovery when it's scientifically unfounded? It's absolutely perverse to talk about fishing, to say nothing of southeast trawlers 1,000 miles away. Thank you.
I'll try to answer that. There's a lot there. Under the Endangered Species Act, we have to evaluate the effects of any federal action that may adversely affect threatened or endangered species. As I mentioned, that 2019 biological opinion looked at three different actions, one of which was the fisheries, the others were the grants program and the prey increase program. We don't have the choice of whether we want to look at those things. We have to. Arguably, there's some discretion in how you bundle those things. You know, did we have to look at them all in one biological opinion? Maybe we didn't, but the fact is we did, and we are where we are, and so we have to deal with that in this litigation. You know, one of the things we're looking at in responding to the court's order is whether we might want to structure that a little bit differently going forward, looking at the fisheries separate from how we look at the effects of the prey increase program, and we're still looking into that issue.
Forward,
Are we going to stop being singled out as Alaskans? I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. I mean, again, the agency has to look at the effects of the Southeast Alaska fisheries, just as we also have to look at the effects of the Puget Sound fisheries and the West Coast ocean fisheries. And all three of those fisheries are tied to this mitigation program. It's intended to release prey in part to offset the effects of those fisheries. So we still have to look at all of those different components. You know, arguably there could be some variation in how we look at them. You know, what again, how we structure the different biological opinions to look at them, but we still have to evaluate the effects. And part of what we've been trying to do in the new analysis, responsive to the deficiencies identified by the court, is to have kind of a comprehensive look within the new analyses, so that it's possible to put the effects of, in this case, the Southeast Alaska fisheries in that broader context. So we're looking at the effects of the Southeast Alaska fisheries in a comparable way to how we look at the effects of the Puget Sound fisheries and the effects of the West Coast ocean fisheries, to try to provide sort of a panoramic view of all those different fisheries' relative effects on the killer whales. I hope that answers your question. Yeah, so a biological opinion focused on any action, it doesn't really get at comparative effects to say, you know, well, the effects of this action are minor compared to these other actions. But we're trying to provide something sort of like that, is what I was referring to, so that the effects from the Southeast Alaska fisheries are viewed in that broader context, the effects of all these fisheries on the killer whales. So I hope that helps.
We do have others who have questions.
I wanted to follow up on something Eric said, and I don't think it got addressed, and that is, and maybe they're not, because they're not federal fisheries, but why are all the sports fishermen in Southeast coming here to, you know, from outside, coming here to take Chinook, that's their focus, and they're not being shut down like the trawlers are in the same waters. So that's, I'd like to understand why that's happened.
Yeah, so the hook here, if you will, is the federal action. So because federal action is required to delegate authority to the Department of Fish and Game to manage the fishery in federal waters, because the federal government is giving grant funding to the Department of Fish and Game to carry out provisions of the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and because the federal government is operating this prey increase program, those federal nexuses need to be, are the reason why we have to do this analysis under the Endangered Species Act. For recreational fishing in the state, I'm not aware of a federal nexus, a federal action that would trigger that same kind of review under the Endangered Species Act.
I'll just start out with my Wanga Muktoyak Nalak Mutun Melissa Johnson. I work for the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Tribal Consortium, which we focus on the Bering Sea side. So thank you for providing the opportunity for us that are interested in different fisheries throughout Alaska. My question is, you had mentioned that how could a potential listing for the endangered species of Chinook in the southeast and the Gulf going into Cook Inlet waters, how could that possibly affect the BSAI fishing, and also from the statewide perspective for the fisheries, how could it also affect the in-river fishery of Chinook if, you know, by the deadline, which is like in a week and a half or so, and if that's, you know, something that is an outcome, and with current litigation issues coming, you know, on the Bering Sea side regarding fishery, you know, salmon fisheries, again, how, if Chinook are listed as endangered species on this end, how could it affect the Bering Sea side? Thank you.
Yeah, so we haven't yet received a petition from the Wild Fish Conservancy. They have said they are going to file a petition, but they haven't yet, so we don't know what the scope of that will be. It sounds like what they're going to be asking for is to list Chinook salmon specifically in Southeast Alaska and South Central and Cook Inlet, not in the Bering Sea. But not having received their petition, we just don't know yet. If it were for those areas, Southeast, South Central, and Cook Inlet, and this is a big if we were to determine that listing is warranted in those areas, I can't think of directly how that would affect Chinook in the Bering Sea, but that's getting a little speculative. You know, we'd have to see what their petition actually looks like when they submit it, and whether that were to lead us to list under the Endangered Species Act. And thank Julie, you. When you get a chance, I know there were a couple up front here too.
So since the outbreak of COVID, the phrase "follow the science" has become very prevalent. And from my perspective, I'm certainly not an expert in this whole battle that we're going through, but isn't one of their positions that they want to eliminate hatcheries? Is that a yes or a no? Or
I don't want to try to represent what Wild Fish Conservancy is all about, but my understanding is they are not fans of hatcheries.
So has there been any type of a scientific complete frontal attack on that argument? Because there seems to be just a complete mind-boggling elementary just distortion of any kind of logic. Because if successful hatcheries provide more food for the orcas, it just seems to me it's a little bit mind-boggling that any type of arguments against that position should really be helpful and undermine the complete premise of their argument.
Yeah, you know, given that they are looking for an injunction to shut down the hatcheries and we are opposing that, I'm not going to get into what our views are of their position on hatcheries. I hear you.
Excuse me for my ignorance, but what has Canada got to do with this, or are they affected by it at all?
Is Canada affected by this? Is that your question? Canada is not affected by the lawsuit. No, the lawsuit is specifically focused on the National Marine Fisheries Service's biological opinion on the Southeast Alaska fisheries and the other components that I mentioned. Yeah, so there is the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which that's really the forum for discussions between the U.S. and Canada over conservation measures, and I don't participate in the Pacific Salmon Treaty negotiations, but my understanding is that's what led to agreement between the U.S. and Canada to reduce harvest of Chinook to promote conservation throughout the range, including U.S. waters and Canadian waters. So, Well, there are discussions between the U.S. and Canada to try to share the conservation burden, but Canada is not directly affected by this lawsuit. No. That's correct.
Yeah, I just recently read that the Federal Department of Justice is getting involved with this particular case, and I wonder if that's going to have a positive effect or a negative effect.
Yeah, so the Federal Department of Justice gets involved whenever the U.S. government is sued. And I get sued all the time. Whenever there's a lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service, it's the Department of Justice that defends us in court. And so they have been involved in vigorously defending us throughout this suit, and they're still involved in this phase as well.
And good afternoon. Now, thank you for coming. Sorry about that. Thanks for coming, and we appreciate you. My question is, could you give us a little history on this group and their background and where their money comes from and just who they are that are suing us? Do you have any of that?
No. I'd invite you all to Google Wild Fish Conservancy and look at their website, but I'm not going to try to characterize who they are and what's motivating them.
Hey, thanks. I'll try to phrase that into a question and maybe answer Walter's question. So WFC has been in over 30 court cases since 2005. They're obsessive serial litigants. I think that's pretty clear. They've established them that way. It appears that they receive a lot of their 80% of their funding appears to be from federal grants. A lot of them are passed through the state of Washington, which on the surface appears that they use to turn around and sue. They use public's money. That's what it looks like on the surface. So that's WFC. And according to their website and their narratives, they want to shut down all mixed stock salmon fisheries. That's what it looks like to me, hatcheries. Why? I don't know why they scapegoat southern resident killer whales is unknown, right? And I'll get back. I'm thinking of the question, John, myself. But our fishery is over 100 years old. It's been sustainably managed for over 100 years. It's the second largest fishery in Alaska in terms of participants. It's the largest fishery in Southeast. It's amongst the third most valuable fishery in Southeast. There's a troll permit in almost all of them, 35 communities in Southeast. It's very unique that way. So doesn't it stand to reason if they could pick something that important that has nothing to do with the case that they make off fishery like this, that they would just pick off the rest of them as well? I mean, isn't that something that the agency would think that seems to be their MO? And that kind of wraps in a lot of the other, I think, questions that people have been asking, why isn't this and why isn't this fishery in that? I mean, they've picked out us, named us in the lawsuit, but it stands to reason that they're after other fisheries next. I don't know, is that something that I know you can't say yes or no who they're coming after next, but it stands to reason in my mind that they're after them all, especially with this petition to list critical habitat along with ESA, Chinook. I'm not even sure. I read that announcement myself. But it just sounds that they're probably going to try to pick off the rest of them as well and keep you really busy in that department.
Well, you're right that they have gone to court many times for many issues, including against our agency. So I would not be at all surprised to see them continue to do that. And as to the, you know, what you said about federal grant funding, I have heard that. I have passed that information along to our attorneys. That's all I can say on that subject.
Hey, we are right at 6:30, but I see there's a couple more
That's
questions.
That's right. I'll take as many questions as you all have.
Yeah, thank you. Just adding to what Jeff said, and this is just me, but
in plain English, I think they're a grift machine is what they are. What they do is they get people all worked up about a fake, it's not a fake cause, because, I mean, the southern resident killer whales are struggling, but for reasons that are endemic to their backyard. It's not because of fishing. But what they do is they get well-intentioned people to donate money to them, and then the group goes on. As Jeff said, they're serial litigants. They've sued, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but NIMPS 20 times in the last 20 years as a plaintiff, something like that. And so, yeah, it's just a way to, and adding on to what somebody else said, it seems like they picked on us specifically because we were scapegoated, because one of the things that's not widely known is that all Sikh fisheries were in the barrel on this. They chose us. They chose partial vacatur. They could have did full vacatur. And one of the responses that WFC brags about, saying, well, yeah, we went easy on you because we could have went after everybody. And it's true. Everybody is in legal jeopardy because of this, which is why these people needed to be defeated. I was moved by what Eric said, and I feel completely the same way. It's a lot of people's livelihoods depend upon this, and it means a great deal. So I thank you again for coming.
Yeah, we know for a fact that the orca don't depend on the king salmon, because since 2019, fishing up off of Cape Cross to Okeechobee, I've had an orca sow and a calf stripping my gear of chum or of cohos for, you know, that's been 4 years that they've been doing that. So we know it's not just Chinook. And the other question I got is, how quick can we get a disaster declaration for losing all our money? What would be the steps to cause that to happen?
So orca diet, I think we addressed previously. You're right, they do feed on other fish besides Chinook. As for disaster funding, I'm not prepared to answer that right now. You know, if worst case scenario, if this fishery cannot open, you know, certainly there'd be a case to be made that it qualifies for the criteria for disaster funding. But I'm not up on all the nuances of that, so I can't really go into that in any more detail. I think you're probably right, but let's hope that we don't have to find out.
Yeah. Hi, Robert Bateman, commercial fisherman, Sitka. It's my understanding that once the ITS and the new buy-up has been written, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can basically put that in effect straight away. Now, if that didn't happen before July 1st, maybe this is for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, but could we maybe go fishing in August still, or something along those lines?
So your question is, if we are not able to get the new incidental take coverage in place by July 1st, but we get it in later, could there be an opening later in the season? Yes.
Hi, my name is Steve Ramp, and I hold the resident sport fishing seat on our local Fish and Game Advisory Committee. This is not our fight, but we support the trollers in this fight, probably to a person in Sitka and everywhere in Southeast. So my question probably asks you to look into your crystal ball, and you probably can't answer it. But for those of us that are Alaska residents that like to go catch a king salmon to eat it, are we next?
I do not have a crystal ball on what these folks are going to do next in drumming up other lawsuits.
Folks, I think we should all give this gentleman and ourselves, because I know there's a lot of anger and anxiety and grief out here, for how well he has done to do his best to answer our, what I would say, and I've been to hundreds of meetings, although none quite like this, I think we should give this gentleman a great big hand and ourselves a hand.
You don't have to do that. It's very kind of you to say. I know that people are really anxious about this, really concerned about this. And, you know, as I said at the outset, I knew coming to Sitka there were going to be a lot of questions about this issue. So that's the reason why I wanted to set this up, was to try to share whatever information I can and answer whatever questions I can. So I'm happy to do it, but thank you. Others?
One other question from a very high level. Globally, there's a lot of talk of this 30 by 30. Is there a lot of impetus within your organization to really start to implement, you know, a lot of that philosophy?
The philosophy of the 30 by 30 initiative?
Yes.
Well, that is a priority of the Biden administration. My understanding is it's, you know, to account for existing conservation, both terrestrial and marine conservation measures that have been put in place. And I'm not involved in this, but I gather that there's a pretty significant effort to take an inventory of those to get a sense of where we are. There's been an awful lot of conservation in Alaska, and I know there's a lot of interest in making sure that Alaska, in effect, gets credit for that in the administration's initiative.
I know we're getting tired, but just one last thing that I think we're puzzled about is, since 1985, our fishery has been taking regular reductions to meet the terms of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. First 20% off our quota, just a fixed historic quota from a base period, we took 20% off. Then we got in a negotiation, we took a sliding scale, 35 to 50% off. Then we took another flat 15% off the sliding scale. Then we took 7.5% off of that. And that's where we are now in our quota reductions, cumulatively, since the treaty was signed. So we were pretty puzzled when this idea of mitigation came up. You know, what? Haven't we been reducing our impacts? And hasn't the Columbia River, who's the biggest proportion of our fishery that is composed of threatened stocks, possibly those upriver brights, been rebuilding, steadily rebuilding the entire time we've been fishing? All of a sudden, there's this new bite of the apple called mitigation. And I don't understand it. And if you can explain why this extra special reduction on top of what we have done was thought to be necessary, or maybe that's just enough. I mean, where did that come from?
I'm really probably not the best person to answer that question. My limited understanding is that the prey increase program, the hatchery program, is meant to try to offset all of the effects from all kinds of different things on both the endangered runs of salmon and the killer whales that that prey upon salmon. So it's sort of separate from the Pacific Salmon Treaty negotiations that you're talking about, that have seen a series of reductions, and Chinook are in decline all over the place. It's not just here. It's a much broader issue. So I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer on that. Yeah. Anybody else? All right, I want to thank you all for coming out. And I hope that we'll have good news in the coming weeks. Stay tuned. Thank you very much.